Self-destructing Chrome extensions go solar.
Hello, welcome to Geek Speak. Recorded May 14th, 2018. I'm Lyle Troxell. Today we're going to have a bit of technical stuff at the end about JavaScript and coding and all that things. So we might be referencing that during the show, but just keep listening if you understand anything about it, and you'll hear the whole conversation at the end. We'll start friendly, though.
We're time traveling today.
Yes, a bit of time traveling. I'm sitting in Los Gatos, California, the fringes of Silicon Valley. I'm talking with two very intelligent developer friends of mine. One you know very well, Miles Cullen Elam. He's a software engineer working in Santa Cruz, a father, farmer, and all-around political junkie. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
And you also know but may not remember Mr. Ben Jaffe. Ben is a software engineer at Facebook and a musician of extraordinaire and still a world traveler.
Who am I? Yes. I guess. Maybe. I don't know.
And you and I happened to do the same thing yesterday. We went off and basically surprised our mothers for Mother's Day.
We did.
How long did you drive?
I was driven in a Lyft to the airport.
Oh, you flew?
Yeah.
Well,
San Diego is eight and a half hours away. It depends.
A 5-hour drive. Yeah. Up in Reading. Any case, happy
good.
Mother's Day to all those mothers out there. You probably saw your mother yesterday as well.
Yes.
Yes, because you're a wonderful son. So we're going to talk about...
and she lives less than 5 minutes away.
There is that too. No, that's more like 10 minutes. Well, I guess 5 minutes from Felton. It's like 10 minutes from my house. Okay. Miles, what's happened? What are we celebrating this year? 40 years ago.
40 years of spam.
And you mean electronic spam.
Yep. Yes.
Not the meat front that Hawaiian seemed like.
Was there? Do we know what the first piece of spam was?
We do. And now I'm trying to remember what it was. I think it was the make money fast from Usenet. But
oh yeah, that sounds like spam.
A long time ago, Miles, you and I think you were there, interviewed a former spammer. He had a book out.
That was a good episode.
Were you there too?
No, I wasn't there, but I did listen.
Yes.
Spammer X.
That episode developed.
Yes. So first off, he was I think he was a Brit. He had a British accent. He wouldn't say where he lived. And it was very clear halfway through the live interview, because this is when we broadcast live, that he was not a former spammer. He was a current spammer. His book said he was a former spammer so that people would read it. But I recall him swearing more than once, and that's rare for radio. And I had to finally tell him to stop. But I was scared of him. By the end of it, I didn't want him to attack my life.
Yeah.
So I was gentle to him. It's an obvious sign of me being a really bad news person. That's why I'm not that. So 40 years of spam. You got any other news from that besides that it still exists?
Yeah.
Is it still profitable?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It is still profitable because you can
just... Do you
remember
when we used to say don't click on ads and emails? We used to say that on Geekspeak.
The amount of money it takes to send hundreds of millions of pieces of email is so low compared to if you get a 0.5% hit rate on which isn't altogether, you know, unlikely. Even like 0.1%, you've already, you know, made your money back and more. So why wouldn't you, especially if you're using other people's resources? Ethics would be the reason why you wouldn't, but yeah.
Some people have those.
And it's funny because moving on to established vendors like Gmail or the like, they have really good spam filters on them.
They really do, yeah.
So you really don't see it as much anymore. And that actually brings me up into the next story.
Well, I have a question first.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask, why are they always spelled poorly?
That is actually on purpose.
No.
Yes.
Why?
Try to spell everything on the up and up, you have a whole lot of people who are going to be intelligent, but then looking up and like, hey, what's going on with this? When you have something that is spelled egregiously wrong, you know, obvious errors, obvious, you know, goofballisms, the people who have a certain level of criticality in their head, they're more critical of what they see, are going to immediately dismiss it, and then you don't have to worry about interacting with them. The only people that interact with you have self-selected that they do not have a very good filter. for BS.
And so they're less likely to interact with you and then ultimately not fall for it.
Right.
If they interact with you, they will probably go all the way because they responded to that email.
Do you think spammers A/B tested into that? Or do you think they just...
Oh, I'm
honestly,
sure.
I'm sure many have, yeah.
Because it's so cheap to send emails.
Right. Just to run a big test. What spelling words will actually equate to a better close rate on the people that call email back?
So it's not just making the spelling mistake, that I believe that many of the mistakes are manufactured, that they do certain... that they have dialed in the type of mistake that will still have gullible people responding, but will filter out more people that are just going to waste their time. It's so weird to me to say the spammer worried about having someone waste their time.
All right. So so spam story of 40 years of spamming slides back into a Google story or
yes,
Gmail story?
That Gmail, as we were saying, has basically eliminated my spam problem. For all intents and purposes, I don't get spam anymore. I just get the stuff that I didn't mean to sign up for, and now I get it, and I need to hit the unsubscribe link. The thing about Gmail is that for a while, they were using it to generate ads based upon the things that you were emailing. And
using Gmail to – okay, so they had some algorithm or something scanning your email, figuring out something about you, and then using that information, that data about you to serve you better ads?
Yes.
That feels weird.
Yeah, so – Google said, we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to scan your email to give you ads.
Okay. Why? What brought them to that decision?
There were privacy concerns.
People were
talking about it.
Okay.
Especially because the conversations in email were considered by people to be privileged. So the idea that you would have an ad come back to you, especially if you're just generally web browsing, could be embarrassing, could be, you know.
That makes sense. Yeah.
It could introduce some liability.
That explains my first feeling when you mentioned it initially. Okay, yeah, so they stopped doing it?
Yeah, so if you're transgender you're sending emails back and forth, you don't necessarily want that just showing up in your ads as you're going to random sites when you're, you know, out and about looking. Now, what has come out is even though Google said, we're not going to do this with ads, and they kept to their word about that, their collective word. It's really weird to say their word when it's a corporation.
Yeah.
What does happen, they're still scanning your Gmail, but they're not using it for ads. They're using it for your search. So the search recommendations as you're typing in that autocomplete, and like that is informed by your email.
When you're typing into search.
Yes.
When you're typing into search.
So, so your search results are basically filtered off you what you might be interested in.
They're prioritized, yeah.
So if you and I are talking a lot about hamsters and then I search for Hammy, I'm more likely to see Hammy the Hamster's website.
Moon over my hamster, yeah.
What's Moon over my hamster? Yeah.
Moon over my Hammy is a Denny's thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or if you're a Tribe Called Quest fan, if you type in ham, it would go ham and eggs, like, because they have that song. On the other side, if you are a hamster aficionado emailing about hamsters, then you type in ham and it's going to autocomplete and say hamster. Mm. It's going to use that information about you to give you a more pertinent search result. Chances are that's not going to erupt in places that you're not expecting it. I mean, Google search is you're at the Google site or you're at the web browser in the search field to do that. So that is a step up from you're on a random site that happens to use Google Ads. Right. And stuff is showing up when you're just browsing it with someone and
trying to
read.
That's probably a
good
improvement. So they've already rolled this out, or they're going to roll this out?
That has already happened. That they said that we're not going to do this for ads anymore. It was what some might consider a lie by omission, because a lot of people assumed, oh, you're not going to scan my Gmail account anymore for content.
Yeah.
No, you still are. You're just going to use it in a different way, and arguably less nefarious way.
So they were just very careful about their wording, and people took it to mean something that was a little bit wider than what they technically said.
Right.
So technically they're in the right, but they're kind of not.
Right.
Right.
Technically in the right, but kind of not.
Which then rolls into a discussion about email in general. And one about another Gmail feature, which is the self-destructing email, meaning being able to send a message and then decide, if you're sending it to someone who's also on Gmail, that after 60 minutes, you know, or after a day, that that email will disappear.
But that's not part of an email protocol, so how do you do that?
Well, it's only with a fellow Gmail
right,
user.
If you're on Gmail.
Okay, but how do you do it? How do you say self-destruct?
When you're composing the email, you will have an option to say expiration date or self-destruct date.
So Hangouts has that. When you're using Hangouts, you can say you're off record or whatever.
That's the idea behind Snapchat, right? Just send a message.
Yeah, a lot of services have that.
Right. Now, the thing about this is, and this is an issue that a lot of people have with the tech industry, is, hey, we have this really neat idea. Wait, have you thought this through all the way about all the possible scenarios that could happen? For example, the self-destruct feature. What if it's used to abuse someone? I'm going to send you an abusive email and then say after they've read it 60 seconds later, it disappears. So there's no proof that they sent that email.
Is it disappear like with really quickly after they read it?
You decide when the self-destruct happens. Hmm. You decide the time frame.
Well, it seems like if you do it a second time, they'll just do a screen capture of it. It's like
it introduces another avenue of abuse.
Yeah.
It's something where thinking of this feature, pretty sure that the people who thought of the feature and implemented the feature are not the demographic that is most likely to experience that type of online abuse.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, you have the issue of you're sending emails and you're a government employee. So there are retention laws associated with it.
So you shouldn't be able to click that box that says delete.
But at the same time, what happens when you have the government employee that's using their personal email, using a personal email account for a government work, and then you have this whole thing, and now all the stuff is gone. Whereas before, at least there was a record of it. You can say, hey, you weren't supposed to use that. Let's go back and do the archive of that and get all those emails.
And then I guess the third piece of it is that the feature may imply that the message will self-destruct and the information will then be gone. But someone could, like you said, Lyle, take a screen capture of it or copy and paste I guess you could block copy and paste, but you wouldn't be able to block someone taking a screen capture of it. And so you're sending, even if you're using it on the up and up, you're sending an email with the understanding that it will disappear and it will no longer be accessible. But that is not actually a guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
So of what use is the feature actually in like any way?
Well, see, here's the thing. That also makes the notion of an intercompany memo
right,
more pernicious. Like that idea of you could give some announcement in the company and it could be having a chilling effect upon speech or something like that. Because corporations in general tend to be autocratic rather than democratic.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you introduce this? Because there are a lot of companies, you know, the company I work for as well, that use Google Apps. You now are sending out memos. Those memos have a self-destruct. I mean, yes, the employees can do screen grabs. Yes, there are ways around that. But it takes away a great deal of liability for corporations, sometimes for good, to say like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff that companies are held liable for that I don't necessarily agree with. But they also take away the liability for bad actors as well,
yeah.
Folks that are mm-hmm. doing it because they know, well, this email will not show up later.
I've got to say, my email chain is such a useful part of my life. You know, recently I wanted to move some money between accounts and I didn't have my account information. I'm like, wait, do I have my account information for this? And I searched for my email and finally found an account number that I needed for some bank account, right? Very useful. And then, of course, I'm thinking, oh, my account number's in my email. That's not good. Like, it has a bad side, too, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I do find it very useful to have my archive history. I feel like I might try to get around that auto-delete thing so that I could have a more complete archive.
It seems it kind of also changes the implicit assumptions that people generally make when they use email. Typically, the email that arrives in your inbox is yours. It is immutable. Someone's not going to reach into your inbox or your labels or folders and delete a piece of email, right?
Right. It feels like part of your data at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you have the ability to delete things or to archive things or to file them away or whatever, or respond to them.
Well, everything about email was tailored upon the metaphor of sending a letter.
Yeah.
Everything about it, like from its early origins, was about this is like sending a letter, only it's through electronic means.
It's like an electronic mail.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the idea of the self-destructing one that you've sent to someone is very much like this. I've sent a letter to someone, and now I'm going to go into their house and take the letter away from them.
But no, you're not taking away it. You're more like destroying it.
But you are taking it away from...
This wasn't Harry Potter, so It's not completely.
And those were regular letters.
No, those are the howlers, right?
Yeah, they self-destruct.
Yeah, they were not regular letters. They would shout at you.
And they spoke.
Yeah, like, don't your letters do that? They destroyed themselves.
No, Ben, don't your letters do that? Yeah. That's what my letters do.
Wait, really?
I meant that they were physical.
Yeah. On the flip side, you have the potential for people who may be not on a repressive government's best terms. Being able to send email and with the knowledge that that email will remove its traces after a certain period of time, that could be a lifesaver.
Yeah, that's true.
Literally a lifesaver. But then again, those people are generally using Snapchat. But then again, Snapchat is known for that and so could be blocked by a government. It's much harder for them to block Gmail at this point.
I guess I just want to ask you a question about that. Like, if the person on the other end is with you and you're trying to send some information and then have it be deleted, shouldn't you just say, hey, friend, delete this when you get this information, you know, like rather than being able to have the control of removing it yourself? It kind of feels weird. Like it breaks the metaphor, and I still don't really see the use case where it's a legitimate use.
Yes, but if you're composing it and you're saying, I really want this to be deleted, and having that automated is a much more powerful way of having that happen.
Sure.
But yeah, there are obvious pros and cons there.
The benefit is so small for the cost, the potential costs.
Yeah. Miles, did you look into if someone's still using like IMAP or POP, if they're using that with their Gmail account, are those messages not available through that protocol?
Well, with IMAP,
they might not be downloadable.
Well, no, with IMAP you will have a local cache, but at the same time, once that message destroys itself and you go to sync back up again, that message will be removed from your local system.
Or they don't provide it through IMAP.
Well, you've done this before.
Remember
we had IMAP and
I used to run it, but it was such a mess and I stopped running it. And the browser app got a lot better. Thank you for that story about Gmail. All right, let's talk about LLVMs. What the heck is that?
LLVM is what you would have, for example, with Clang.
No, that doesn't help me at all.
It's an alternate object code generation tool. So
wait, sorry. Let's back up again. What do you mean? What kind of code?
So if you write C.
Okay.
If you use the Clang compiler, that's going to compile to LLVM opcodes.
Usable across multiple processors.
Multiple languages and multiple processors. And then LLVM will take that opcode, those opcodes, and then convert them into native code for whatever the target machine is.
Okay.
So that means you don't have to have a C compiler that knows everything it needs to do to go to machine code, to an executable. You have this intermediate layer.
Okay, stop.
Okay.
Let's try to explain this to someone that's not a software developer. Let's do a metaphor, please.
Well, I guess you could say instead of trying to convert from Spanish to English, you convert from Spanish to Esperanto, and everyone just converts to go to Esperanto, and then you do from Esperanto to English.
Okay.
The idea being that you all have a single target, and then that target can go from Esperanto to Spanish or Esperanto to English or Esperanto to German. But all of these languages would have a common target, a fixed target that you would go to, a very regular language, not really a living language. So that helps with its regularity. And then from there, you optimize the case for Esperanto out to Spanish, Esperanto out to French. It separates that.
Okay, I kind of understand that task. Idea. And the benefit of that is that you could have a German speaker and a Spanish speaker, and you could be speaking in English, and all of you have like this middle ground, and therefore, once it's in the middle ground, you have translators that are really good for all the languages.
Right.
I get that. That's cool.
So if you come across a language that is hitherto unknown, there's a tribe in the Amazon that has never had human contact before, and you find out what the language is about, and then you write that tribe's language, convert to Esperanto, then you have the bridge point to say, oh, now I get to Esperanto. Esperanto can then go to all the other languages. Now, obviously, that is a very loose metaphor.
Yeah.
Human languages are not the same as computer languages. They're nowhere near as logical.
And they're not nearly as translatable.
That's the metaphor.
Okay. All right. Go on. So that's what LLVM is this kind of opcode translation of other languages that any other language can use if it speaks that language.
Yes.
Okay. Now your story.
LLVM has contributors, an open source project. And one of their top contributors just resigned, just left. And this is a curious case where the person left because they consider a social injustice to have occurred. And that social injustice was there was an internship given to try to encourage women and other minority groups to get involved in free software development. Because of a single internship slot, This person said, this is not okay that we are, well, to take his quote, actually. The reason for me leaving are changes in the community. The current license change discussions unfortunately bring to memory the Free Software Foundation's politics when I was working on GCC. That would still not be sufficient reason to leave. As with code, LLVM will still have the best license, and if the only community change was the handling of the license change, I would probably keep going. The community change I cannot take is how the social injustice movement has permeated it. When I joined LLVM, no one asked or cared about my religion or political view. We all seemed committed to just writing a good compiler framework. Which in and of itself seems logically plausible, aside from the saying social injustice movement, which is an obvious reaction to social justice.
So an internship was set up in the LLVM's corporate group or the nonprofit group?
Yeah, from the foundation. The umbrella, yeah.
And they, what they did in that internship is they opened up to women only.
And other minority groups.
Oh, okay.
Folks who are underrepresented in tech.
So they're using the internship to broaden the diversity of the group.
Yes.
It's pretty valid, assuming that you think that diversity is a good thing.
Now, this wasn't about, oh, we're doing this en masse. Like, it was literally one slot, and that was a bridge too far to say, like, no one cared about my religion or political view. And it's like, yeah, okay.
All right. Well, thank you for that story. Let's move on to your overflow, Stack Overflow. Ben, you want to describe Stack Overflow to us?
It's a website named after a thing that happens in software sometimes. So it's a website where people can ask questions and answer questions that they know the answers to. And it's become somewhat of a community. It, typically, if you Google a programming question, you will probably find mostly Stack Overflow.
Like, can you cancel a promise? I want to cancel a promise. And you go in there and they talk for a while, and they'd say, oh, you want to use Bluebird promises. And then you can cancel.
Basically.
Yeah. Second link.
Second,
is it possible to force cancel a promise?
Right. So people talk about a problem, then answer it, and you actually kind of get karma points for doing that. So you get it. You kind of gain a reputation in that environment to be able to answer things and such. Okay, yes. We know what Stack Overflow is. What's up?
The same type of thing was happening there, where it was not feeling very welcoming. You were thinking, like, Stack Overflow, but that's just people posting responses. Except that people who were there, there's this toxic culture that's also an undercurrent there, which is someone asks a question. And then a moderator who may be, you know, overzealous comes in and says, I'm closing this question because it's not useful, you know, or it's been asked before, which then leads the person who asked the question to go like, wow, how dumb am I if I'm asking this question and I'm being told the question's not smart enough to be asked.
Examples of valid times when you might want to say, no, this question's not viable.
Those are ones where it's a value judgment, like which open source database project has the best community.
Right.
It's a value judgment.
And yeah. What we're trying to do is actually answer concrete answers in there.
Yeah. Like, what is the best so-and-so? Like, it's a value judgment. But if you ask a concrete, like, what is the answer to how would I solve this problem?
Right. How do I reorder a list in JavaScript?
Yes.
What's a list in JavaScript?
I get the idea of what, but the other thing is, like, someone might say, hey, how do I paint my garage? And you're like, no, that's not a software engineering problem. This is more about software engineering,
sure.
Right? So there's definitely reasons why you'd want people to make sure that the questions are valid. You want to remove spammers. Someone might be just using this as a spammer. So there's really good benefits from that.
Yeah. I might ask the question, hey, are promises cancelable in JavaScript? And a moderator will say, hey, did you search? Like, it's right here.
Right, but sometimes they don't answer it that way. That's the thing I see.
Right, yeah.
You don't ever do this. It's here, obviously. And then they link to something that's not really your question.
And that would be legit, actually, to just say, this has been asked before. Here's the link to
right.
the one where
because you want to actually aggregate all the dialogue about it. You want to aggregate together. What if someone comes up with a better answer and then in one place? So you link new questions to older questions when they're viable.
Right. But that's not necessarily what's happening. You're having a lot more people saying, like, this is not the right way to do it. This is, you know, why are you doing this? This is dumb. You know, things that are a bit more
judgmental.
Yes. And they can be very off-putting to someone. One of the reasons why people go to Stack Overflow is they're learning. This is a go-to site for people who are starting out, they're not familiar with a particular architecture, or they're just starting off with programming. To have your first interactions on a site be, yeah, that question was too dumb. It's been asked before, and you know, you should be knowing better. You should know better than this. That scolding aspect is a deterrent to new people coming in. And the fact is, everyone was a beginner at some point. That person who was that rude in this particular case used to be the person who didn't know as much, and either someone was rude to them and they're passing it, you know, paying it forward, or they've forgotten what it's like not to know.
Additionally, seeing an implementation of something that's close to what you want to do in a language or in a library that you haven't used before is so much faster than crawling through the documentation.
The other thing, when someone says please, or when they respond thank you to what's coming in, someone telling them that stop that, that's just noise. You don't need to give that, you don't need to say thank you and add noise to the site.
Can't you do the like? You can vote it up and stuff.
There is, yeah, there's up. But that idea
that. Okay, so are they going to change this? Are they going to modify it?
Like you're using it wrong thing.
Right.
Are they changing it? That's the thing. It's a community problem, so that's going to require a community change. Yes, the people who run Stack Overflow are looking at it and trying to make it better, but it's ultimately going to have to do with the user base. And this also overflows onto the chats. So they're not a specific question. They're a forum to ask about JavaScript. So you would think, hey, if I went over to the Stack Overflow JavaScript forum, what would they be talking about?
I didn't even know they had forums.
They call them chats, but yeah, they're open chats. If you were wanting to talk about JavaScript and you went to this forum, what would you expect to see there?
They'd be berating the bad sides of promises.
One particular person that I came across on Twitter, and he posted about this, was he went to the forum and they were talking about the pros, cons, social costs, benefits of legalized prostitution.
In the JavaScript forum.
In the JavaScript forum.
Seems a little off topic.
He then pointed out, hey, folks, this is the JavaScript forum. This is my first time here, but this seems like it's off topic and it could be off-putting to someone who doesn't want to talk about this topic. You know, when they just
want to talk about JavaScript.
Yeah, when they came in for a technical conversation and then, you know, we're confronted with a bunch of guys talking about the pros and cons of prostitution. And he was basically shattered down, like, why are you trying to be so offensive? Why are you trying to be so confrontational with people? You are the one that's introducing discord.
So obviously not a welcoming environment.
Right.
I didn't even know that. I seriously didn't know that they had forums, but I would definitely not want to engage because it seems so aggressive environment. And I answer those questions sometimes.
Right. And this is something that just amazes me when someone says, well, tech isn't all that toxic. Like, I hear people say, like, I don't see what the big deal is. You know, maybe some people just need to get a thicker skin or whatever. And I think of Slashdot, which has been around since forever. For folks who are on Slashdot, like, I have a 5-digit ID, a user ID. So I've been there for a while. It's funny how when there's a technical conversation, you will see technical answers. Although you will also see the troll comments in there where someone has nothing to do with the content and they just feel like being racist and sexist in there. And you just kind of say like, oh, well, those are trolls. Ignore them, right? Whenever there is a conversation about women in tech, for example, even if it's about, hey, we're celebrating this particular woman in tech who was ignored for a great deal of time, let's say a NASA computer scientist, you will have people coming out of the woodwork talking about how it is not worth talking about. You know, this is supposed to be news for nerds. Even when the previous story was something about, I don't know, Dragon Ball Z.
Right.
And people going like, oh, yeah, well, this is a nerdy topic. That it's so pervasive, it just boggles my mind that people say that it doesn't happen. Like, it seems to me like I could sit anyone down on any given day and say, let's find a story that is the closest possible to something that would be what people consider a social justice warrior, or something that talks about diversity or inclusion, and just go through the comments. Obviously, don't read the comments. Never read the comments is advice that people have for the internet, but it's there. The reason you don't is because there is this constant background noise of hatred.
What do you do about that?
What do I do about it?
What do we do about it as a society?
Well, I would say the first step would be acknowledging that there's a problem. But, I mean, know, that's the first step in that 12-step program.
We've known about that for a long time, and there's like, you know, talk show hosts.
No,
talk
we
about
have
it.
Known about that.
No, talk show hosts talk about the trolls of the internet. Like that's a meme that we have.
Yes,
but the fact that a lot of people are still denying that it is a problem is a problem. That's like a problem that we have to solve before we can solve the problem that they're denying is a problem.
So you're not saying that the trolls are the problem. The problem is the unacceptance of diversity there? Because I'm just saying that in general in society, people understand that forums are full of people on the internet. Don't argue with people on the internet. That's a funny meme that people talk about. Like that's known that people are crappy on the internet. So we know that aspect. That's public accepted, right? Or am I missing something?
Yes, and it's not necessarily acceptable. It's this notion of we're going to have these tech forums, and these tech forums are going to be in the comments, abusive towards people who are underrepresented in the tech community. And if you are not one of those groups, there's a tendency for people to just say like, oh, like because it's not directed at them, they perceive how much it hurts them to be a universal that they project onto others. Like, I don't consider it that hurtful personally, therefore no one should. That you should just toughen up. Or if someone is rude to them, it's usually on the course of like usually a response to something they said. And so they equate that response to something they said as something they need to toughen up about, or like there's going to be constant ribbing, to someone who is getting ridiculed or abused about who they are. Not anything they've said, but by their mere presence, they are being attacked.
Right.
And that's something that people just haven't come to grips with yet. A huge swath. And when you do have some people that you have brought around and say, hey, take a look at this. Look, there's this thing that's happened. There's always a whole new crop of people that are coming in new that say there isn't a problem. That, you know, you have to, because there's always a constant influx.
Yeah.
There's always a new generation.
Well, Miles, that's a hard, depressing problem that I don't know if we have a good answer for. So it's really hard to engage in it. Ben, would you cheer us up with something, maybe a really cool Chrome extension or something, please?
I can't cheer you up. I'm sorry.
You can't? You have something depressing for us?
I can't cheer you up.
Okay.
The story that you are referring to is titled Malicious Chrome Extensions Infect 100,000 Plus Users Again.
I thought it was going to be a cool Chrome extension.
This is just kind of my little soapbox, so I'll just step onto it for a brief moment and say that Chrome extensions are and always have been a really horrible, horrible idea.
You've developed Chrome extensions.
I've developed a lot of Chrome extensions, yeah. But I think, so the only reason they are a bad idea is that people, it's a permissions thing. It's an access thing, right? Like Android had this problem for a very long time where you would download an app and it would say, I need access to your phone. You're this, you're that, the other. And once you get past like two items or three items on that list, the user doesn't read it anymore. And so the difference between access to your data on the website /.com, for example, versus all data on all websites you visit, like that's a very small difference from the user's experience perspective because they just see this big wall of permissions and they accept it, right?
There's also the granularity associated with it, too.
The granularity thing. So the problem with Chrome extensions is that when you install them, they ask for permission when you install them rather than having some sort of a thing that's ongoing.
Prompt you as you use this feature.
Yeah, and there's not enough disincentive to install them. It makes sense that there's not a huge disincentive to install them because security is always a probabilistic thing, right? Like you either don't get hacked, you don't get hacked, and you don't get hacked, and you don't get hacked, and then one day you eventually get hacked. But all the time that you're not getting hacked, you're not really thinking too hard about security because it's not being brought to the forefront of your consciousness. So I imagine that the people on the Chrome extension team, their incentive is to get people installing Chrome extensions and to support this new developer platform that they've built, which is really like very cool. It's a very cool platform. You can do a lot of good things, but people will install these Chrome extensions, accept these far-reaching permission requests.
And this could be a problem in any kind of environment.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's not a unique problem right. to Chrome extensions, but the reason I say Chrome extensions are especially bad is that they still haven't really fixed this.
Right. This it's is the problem that Apple dealt with by saying we're going to have an audit process. Mm-hmm. And audit processes are expensive.
And a best practice of suggestions as well of things like, you know, when you want to use the camera, that's the time to ask. Right. So it's like there's a purpose for it rather than I'm downloading the camera, get all the permissions up front. Mm-hmm. Go on. Yes.
Yeah, not as much of an issue with the browser as it is, say, with a mobile device. True. But that separation between do you have access to the camera? Do you have access to your photos? And for a while, those were being conflated. It's just like you want access to your camera. And that also gives access to the camera roll. And
right.
it's like, no, those are two different things. I want to be able to take a photo, like, you know, upload a photo, for example, from this, you know, a picture for me. But I don't necessarily want to give the app access to all of my pictures. Once again, I go back to the iOS model, how I thought they did very well, which was, yeah, you can say I want to choose an image, I want to choose a picture from my gallery, but the app never saw that. You had the operating system bring up your gallery, and then you chose, that's the image I want, and then the app received this blob saying, okay, here's your image data.
Your one image data.
Well, yeah. What would you recommend in this case when you're as a Chrome user to like I would recommend reviewing your extensions you have installed.
Review your extensions and don't install very many.
This was something that while I was at Google I thought about as mm-hmm. well, which was right now if you have an extension that is a highlighter, for example, on
right.
a page, whatever, that means that you have to be given access to the contents of that page.
Right.
And I had always thought, wouldn't it be great, and I never got around to it, obviously, if you had a permission, a different level of permissions that was, you are told, here's a document. You are told, this is the fifth, you know, node of the...
You only get the subsection.
You only are told a, not even so much, even a path, or like, you're basically told, like, someone has highlighted something and you're told a path and you say, okay, I'm going to say that information. So the next time it comes in, you are able to replay data onto the page, but mm-hmm. The extension would have no knowledge of the page itself.
So you get a lot of
the URL or anything like that.
So you get a lot of the benefits of having access to everything, but the Chrome extension doesn't actually have access to everything. It just has access to the things that the user is interacting with.
Right.
Which the user is not going to go and like, you know, use the highlighter app to highlight their username and password on a page. Like, that's probably just not going to happen. But the way it is right now is if you install that highlighter app and that highlighter app is malicious, then the highlighter app can just kind of quietly watch everything that you do, grab all of your usernames and passwords, send them off to some...
Which
you
many,
know,
some of them program. Have done.
Yeah, definitely. So this particular article, and the details of this are actually not really very important in my opinion, because it's just the same thing over and over again. But the particular extensions, the way that they got people to install the extensions is that they pushed links to people over Facebook, which led them to a fake YouTube page. And the YouTube page said, hey, you need to install this extension. And they wanted to see the content on the fake YouTube page because they thought it was real YouTube. So they installed the extension. Once the extension was installed, most or all of these through just JavaScript made the computers a little botnet. The botnet or the code stole Facebook and Instagram credentials, collected details from social networks and whatnot. And then it also sent itself to all of the friends of the infected person. So it would self-replicate.
Through like their email client or whatever.
Right. Or through Facebook, right?
Yeah, pretty devious.
Man. Yeah. And then the other thing is that these Chrome extensions actually mined cryptocurrency.
Yes.
In JavaScript. Mining
Very
Monero and Bitcoin and
inefficient,
Electronium.
But it's not your money. Like, it's not your hardware. So it's that whole spam thing of like a lot of people back in the day sending to SMTP servers that were open relays. Because it wasn't your money. It wasn't your infrastructure. You didn't have to pay for it. So it was effectively free for you to do the bad things. The Bitcoin mining, sure, it could be more efficient. But you're running it on 1,000 or 10,000 machines that aggregate aggregate it. So
yeah, it's free to you. So anyway, just be careful about Chrome extensions. There are a lot of them out there. There are a lot of... there are a lot of Chrome extensions, and I've never seen any of this type that have been malicious, but that will, as you're browsing the web, they'll replace instances of one word with another word. And usually they're really funny. Like during the election, there is one for Trump, and it would replace it with something. I don't remember what it was. I actually made my own version of it that replaced wine with blood wine and beer with Romulan ale and like all of these Star Trek references. Yeah. And I have like, I think, like 80 people installed it. I didn't try to market it or anything. My dad did have it installed, though. And at one point, I'm on the phone with him, and this is like for months he's had this installed, and he forgot about it. He's like, what is this Ractogino thing? Like, is this new coffee or something? And I'm like, Dad, that's Bajoran coffee. That's
so you had coffee being replaced
with
Bajoran
coffee? Yeah, you thought this new trendy coffee. But so Chrome extensions are really, really cool. And they're a really bad idea as they are right now. So just be very careful. And just to close out the story with a personal story, my partner installed this Chrome extension. It tried to do something like it would automatically unsubscribe you to things that you had been subscribed to. I don't remember the details of it, but it was one of those really useful seeming services, and it actually worked. And so there was this article written about how great it was and everyone should install it, and she was going to install it. I said, you just be careful because, you know, Chrome extensions are a really bad idea. And so she put it off. And then a day later, there was an article that said that that particular extension had been harvesting people's passwords. And like,
goodness, yeah.
So just be careful. Just be careful.
I do want to do a nice little postscript on that, which is, how could this be solved? How could this be mitigated? And one of the ways that it could be mitigated from a technical standpoint is Google keeping track of the extensions that are installed into a browser. If you see a spike of like a certain amount, you go and you programmatically go and vet them and see, you can do some programmatic analysis. That requires that you think that it's okay for Google to scan the things that you are adding to your web browser. And so it's this weird put give and take of the most effective way for them to stop that is to spy on you.
I mean, you can make the same arguments for apps on a phone, but that's just socially acceptable, right? It's expected that Apple will know what is installed because Apple runs the App Store and you download things through there. And to be fair, also Google runs the Chrome whatever store.
They do, but a lot of these extensions are sideloaded. You're going to a URL that's not hosted by Google. And so
Google made it harder to do that. You do get a lot more warnings when you do that. If you go through a Google Chrome extension, through Google Play or whatever it is,
But regardless, I would argue that the social expectation is there. That because the typical path to installation is going to the Google Chrome extension store and then downloading or installing from there, because that's the accepted path, I don't think people would see it as Google spying on them.
Yeah.
Much in the same way as you don't think of it as Google or Apple spying on you when you download apps.
Yeah, and also the marketing aspect of how do you pay for that aspect of it. Every developer that develops on an Apple device actually pays a fee of like $100 a year. That's not a lot, but at least it makes it be a slight barrier, and there's some money coming in for every developer. So there's some incentive for them to spend time, you know, looking at the apps. There's some money there for it. And of course, when the ones make lots of money. So it's a little different because these Chrome extensions, there's no revenue being...
You know, there's one other thought that actually just crossed my mind. While it seems not too creepy, at least to me, for Google to know what extensions you have installed, the thing that does feel more creepy to me is for Google to keep track of what servers, for example, your extensions are communicating with and how much data is being sent to various servers.
That seems creepy to you?
That seems creepy to me because you're not keeping track of what I have installed. You're keeping track of what I am doing through that installed
software. And I think Miles is saying to alleviate this problem, knowing that data of what, like, oh my gosh, Chrome extension is passing tons of data. Every time they log in, their data goes to the server. Like, that is important information, yeah. But it is creepy if you don't like that aspect because it'd be too spy.
I don't dislike that aspect, but I see how it would be – I see how it would be considered creepy.
And that's where I would think you would do a static analysis. Like, when you do the extension – because the extensions are written in JavaScript, you know, and the like, that you can do analysis on the code to see, oh, there's this pathway that's going toward –
but
can
you
can't. Can you do eval in the code?
You can't quite. You can't fully statically analyze JavaScript. There are ways around that.
Yeah,
especially
but you can,
especially if
but
you're
you can also
input.
Detect obfuscation techniques too.
Like, but can't you, you also just include? Can't you just include code from a URL? Yeah, you can. So.
But yeah. you can look and see that there is an eval of a remote.
You can just include like a
add a script tag that points to a somewhere.
Right, but that is detectable. That is
that's not a bad thing to do.
It's acceptable to add a script tag that points to a remote resource.
This is an example of them doing something wrong though.
But this, yeah. So like I was
you can just include jQuery for example if you want.
Like, I've done a lot,
which is a shame.
Yeah. jQuery or
well, the idea of that resource as opposed to your extension should bundle and be an island unto itself, that you shouldn't be able to take in scripts from other places, because that's just even extensions that aren't malicious, that's a cross-site scripting attack that's waiting to happen.
And it's actually fascinating the way that they've tried to handle this. They've tried to put up those walls between the memory space of your extension versus the memory space of the page, but then you still need to be able to modify the page, and so they have to open up certain things. They've secured it down pretty decently, but I had an actual legitimate case where I needed to get over that wall, and they put up the wall, and so I found another way around it. And it was really a pain in the butt to do, but once I had it set up, I was able to communicate both ways and extricate. What is the word?
I don't know, but it's great.
I'll find
that
word.
If you know the answer to Ben's question, please email us.
But it is possible to take data out of the memory space of the web page that your Chrome extension is ostensibly running on. It is possible. It's very difficult now, but it is still possible. It's not as controlled of an environment as...
Basically, don't install Chrome extensions unless you absolutely know the authenticity of it and the intentions behind it.
Yeah.
And if you actually need it. Most cases, you don't need the extension.
The best Chrome extension I've used is this little thing that we use Google Calendars here and also Gmail and such. And somebody's written an extension where all the rooms that we use for meetings... are, of course, you know, in a certain floor of a certain building. You never know what they are. Hmm. And this Chrome extension basically just looks at the calendar entry and appends a map to the floor that that room is on. That's all. Just so great. But not very useful anywhere else. And then I end up making a lot of bookmarklets. I code my own things that want to turn. Like when I want to pretty print a JavaScript, I have a little bookmarklet. I could make it a Chrome extension, but I don't know. It's a little easier just to have a bookmarklet.
I have Tabs Outliner, which is a really fantastic extension that lets you basically manage your tabs and offline your tabs and then re-online your tabs in a really convenient way.
See, you're saying bad things about Chrome extensions, and then you just gave me one I'm going to install.
Well, the reason that I'm mentioning it...
As opposed to not being a pack rat of your tabs.
Are you a sawtooth tabs user? As in, your tabs look like a little... the two teeth of a saw?
Well, I have a very large monitor at my desk. Uh-huh. And a smaller laptop monitor. And right. So when I leave my desk, yes, sometimes they are condensed down.
It just becomes useless. No, but I was curious. I just looked up the permissions because I remember that I thought it was good enough to install given the amount of utility it gives me. And its permissions are to read your browsing history, to display notifications, and to know your email address. And the know your email address is to allow the developer to have a premium version.
Know your browser history is a lot of data.
Your browser history, yes, but not any of the content on the pages or any of that stuff. If that was a permission that he requested, I would have thought, oh yeah, you probably need that in order to manage like opening and closing and moving tabs and things like that.
He just needs the titles of the pages, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems kind of legit. But if it did ask to get all of my data from all pages, I would have said, no. It's convenient. It's a really good extension, but no. So.
Body cams for police officers. We just think of them in terms of this is a body camera. Like police have body cams. They've been installed in, you know, variety of different departments, and we've seen a lot of coverage from them, news stories from that point of view. As it turns out, there is a near monopoly in body cams.
Really? One company makes all the body cams?
One company, known as Taser,
Oh, I've heard of them.
Has acquired its largest rival, ViVue.
So now they're a monopoly.
So they're a near monopoly. And it's that notion of this is something that is very much in the public interest, right? Whether how these act and
do
how they perform.
Do these store everything on the device or do they upload
I don't know, and I would imagine it depends upon the model.
It's a lot of power.
So, I mean, there's most likely more than one model, but they're all by if they're all by the same company, that means they would all have the same vulnerabilities if there was an exploit going on. They would all have the same shortcomings. And for that matter,
they also don't have the incentive to innovate and get better.
Right. And there's also that aspect of corruption. If someone decides they want to have a backdoor to manipulate the data, whatever, if that company were caught, is there a rival that can pick up the slack and that they can source from another vendor? That same thing with like Internet Explorer in the early 2000s of ActiveX was a horrible security model. And yet, even though people saw that, there wasn't an easy alternative to use something else.
I just love that ActiveX is like extensions 101, like the first time people try to use browser extensions. Just like, here, just run anything you want on the person's computer, be delivered through the internet.
They were actually the second. Netscape plugins happened before then, but ActiveX made it so that you didn't have to do the install and then restart your browser to get it. It was just inline running executable code.
All right, Miles, tell me about what California has done. I heard about this recently.
California has become is scheduled to become the first U.S. state that mandates solar panels on all new homes.
Now, I was wondering if it was solar panels or alternative energy.
And so, there are exceptions. Uh-huh. There are exceptions where they say solar doesn't make sense in this environment.
I'm building a house in a cave.
Or in the middle of a forest. But it is something that is pushing forward. And some people were asking about, like, wait, you're putting in this legislation to add in solar, and they were thinking of it purely as a private property issue. And the more I thought of it, the more I perceived it as being a public policy issue with the grid. Everyone knows, like it's common knowledge, that the U.S. in general has an aging power grid, that it was designed in, you know, more than 50 years ago and has had, you know, patch upon patch upon patch, you know, trying to make it work. And we've also seen the result of it, you know, what was it, 15 years ago, there was the blackout on the East Coast that took out like basically all of the East Coast and part of Canada into Quebec for an extended period of time. And it was due to one part fell, so then the load went up and just cascaded all the way through. So when you have solar panels put onto everyone's homes, when it's all new homes, the grid becomes decentralized.
You know, of course, the benefit to society in general makes a lot of sense. And the whole argument against it about, you know, well, I don't want to have a house with solar panels on it. Well, you might also not want a house with, I don't know, a bathroom. But you have to put a bathroom in a house if you want to live in it. And you also have to have electricity in it. You can't get a permit unless you're going to have electricity. So there are a lot of things we mandate homes. I don't know, like earthquake viability that are just part of the code. So this is just another one. It doesn't seem like
– right. And it gets me the people that are – hell-bent about like, oh, this is just new taxes. Oh, this is new way for you have to do this, are also the same people that I find don't argue as much with regard to defense, the defense industry, defense spending. This is a way to make the grid less hackable and less susceptible to like a bomb. When you have a fully decentralized grid like that, if you blow up a neighborhood, that is a tragedy in and of itself, but it doesn't take down all of the surrounding city's power like it would with many of our power plants right now. If you took out a major distribution center, that's going to take out a wide area for an extended period of time because those are custom parts.
I know I've lived in my house for about a year, and people are always asking me about if I'm going to get solar. What are some of the things I should watch out for with regards to solar? Any suggestions?
One of them is an analysis that says that the installation costs have now outweighed the cost of the panels themselves. That panels are dropping in price faster than the labor to install them. Meaning that now they're just becoming almost a free part of the deal. where it makes more sense to put a higher quality panel up and pay that extra marginal cost because the overall cost of installation is going to dwarf it. And you're going to get more of a return and be able to pay back that investment faster. So it makes more sense to get the 22% efficient panels rather than the 16% efficient panels. Even though the 22% efficient panels are more expensive, the cost of getting someone up on your roof, putting them in, wiring it up to your house, hooking it up to the power grid to have the switch over, maybe having a battery backup in your house, you know, all of that, the cost difference for the panels shouldn't be the driving decision anymore.
Well, thank you very much, Miles. Hi, Ben. Got any other stories closing up?
I do. I have one story in, we can file it in the It's About Time category, along with the solar panel ones. Ever heard of Windows Notepad?
The app?
I know the story. This is hilarious.
The Windows Notepad app?
Yeah, Windows Notepad. No, the Windows application from way back in the day.
The original IDE that I used to code Java in back in 1997.
You used to do that, didn't you? You used to use Notepad.
Yeah. It made me a better coder, too, because there's no help whatsoever.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Can you even select a line?
Once I wrote HTML in that, and God, I forgot a bracket. I forgot one bracket.
It was very common when you're on a Windows machine where you're like, you want to edit something, and all you have is that.
Simple text editor.
Open up HTML. Yeah, yeah. You had to make sure to change the setting so it wouldn't do smart quotes on you because it would really mess up your HTML.
No. That was...
Notepad wouldn't do that word.
This is Notepad. This is like...
Notepad wouldn't do that.
Bare bones of the bare bones.
There was something that had problems with it.
Anything besides ASCII?
Yeah. Anything but Notepad. Do you remember any issues with Notepad? I always loved Notepad because it just worked for everything.
Couldn't do alternate character encodings. It said ANSI, which isn't actually a character encoding. They meant ASCII. And even then it was...
Oh, that's what ANSI is.
That's awesome.
I never knew what ANSI was. Okay, ASCII. Windows Notepad, ever since it was born until very recently, only supported text documents containing Windows end-of-line characters.
Yes.
So carriage returns, line feeds. That meant if you made a text document on, say, a Mac or on any Unix machine or Linux machine, your line breaks just wouldn't show up. You would open it in Notepad and it would just be this long form blob of gobs of text.
Did they fix that?
They finally fixed it. They finally
fixed.
Now,
why?
Now point of order here. Windows now includes a distribution of Linux with it. They bundle Ubuntu with it. They included a Unix clone before they fixed their text editor to read Unix line endings. Let that sink in.
This is on Microsoft's blog, May 8th, 2018. They finally fixed this.
Do you think some dev just was like, this is stupid, and just went and did it?
I love the way it's
written. And it supports UTF-8 correctly now.
It does now, yeah. They say, this has been a major annoyance for developers, IT pros, administrators, and end users throughout the community. New line. All in bold. Today, we're excited to announce that we have fixed this issue! Exclamation mark. And that's their
they
little blog post.
They should not be proud of that.
This hit me at my current job, line endings.
We hope that you find this change useful and look forward to hearing your feedback.
There was some code in VB6. The person who checked in the repository, probably when they opened up their text editor, they had all these extra lines. And so they resaved it and stripping out the character turn new line and just made it a new line. And then checked it into the GitHub repo. Uh-huh. So then when I pulled it out of the GitHub repo and tried to get VB6 to run it, it wouldn't. It would never build. And I'm like, what is going on? And I was asking the company that I got it from, like, what's going on? And they're like, oh, it works for us. We have it running in production. I don't know what's going on.
Miles, can you back up for a second? You're working on VB code?
I was porting VB6 code to Node.
Okay, so you needed to run it. So
yes.
You could port it.
But I wanted to have a reference. And I couldn't get the reference running. It was like, what is going on? If it's on Windows, it's going to look for the carriage return new line.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't have that...
If it's any other new line. And there are three new lines.
Then it doesn't see it as a new line, in which case the basic just looks as a single line. You don't... Because basic is new line terminated for commands.
Yeah. So new lines are kind of important.
Kinda.
Especially in the language that Microsoft made, VBScript.
I also had a similar issue.
And this was actually the sorry just to yeah, just please, to finish ahead. Off is never trust anyone. Everyone lies, including the person who's on your team that checks in the code. Like,
yeah.
And of course, he left soon afterwards. So then,
you know, the interesting thing about that too is that lots of times a visualization tool that allows you to kind of see the diffs and stuff, you can say ignore new lines because, or you know, white space changes because white space changes don't matter that much.
The reason why I was able to find the problem was because I wanted to do a quick edit on it. Just because I was like, well, maybe if I try and change just one thing. So I opened it up in Notepad, and it was all in a single line in a blob. And I went,
Notepad saved you.
Notepad showed me what the error was.
Wait a second.
Well, now it won't anymore.
You should write to them and tell them to put it right back.
You should tell them, keep the feature. I rely upon it. What was your story about?
It's a similar thing of like, it was carriage returns. I was using the extend script toolkit to write extend script for scripting Adobe After Effects, which is just, there's so many things wrong with the sentence I just said. Never, ever do that. Never do it. Never. But I was. And so I was using their IDE rather than using my own IDE. I was using their IDE because they had breakpoints in it. And
I don't
and
know
stuff.
What extend script is.
Extend script is a version of ECMAScript 4.
Okay. That Adobe uses?
4. Have you ever written an ES4?
So that's basically ActionScript.
Maybe.
No, you've written an ES3 and ES5. ES4 was the version.
ActionScript. It was basically.
ActionScript was based on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
ES4 was the version of ECMAScript that everyone was like, oh, we can add all these kind of clever things and host objects and stuff. And then the entire community actually agreed that it was a horrible idea, and then we skipped to 5. And that's why you have ES3 and ES5, and nobody uses ES4 aside from Adobe After Effects for their scripting language.
No.
They have zero.
Flash.
But Flash is not really around anymore. So, and also.
But that's where it was. I mean, that's where it showed up the most that I found.
Yes, but was that ES4?
It was actually ScriptScript. And so it was a superset of ES4.
Was it ES4 or ES3?
I think it was ES3.
No, I'm pretty sure it was like ES4 or
4.1. Did it have one indexed arrays and zero indexed arrays?
Wait, how would you?
Yeah, you see, this is what I'm saying. They had a lot of clever things that were bad ideas.
I did a lot of ActionScript.
So you write a for loop and you say I equals 0, I++, and you get a failure. And you assume that the failure is at the end of the array, that you're going too far. But in fact, no, you're starting before the array begins. It's horrible. Anyway, but I checked in a bunch of carriage returns, and our version control system was like, this is not okay. No carriage returns, please.
That's good that it
And then I learned what a carriage return was, and I learned how it's very difficult to debug whitespace issues. And then that actually came in handy later because with internationalization, there's the left to right marker and the right to left marker. There's a word joiner, which there's a zero width non-breaking space. All of these things are zero width. They're invisible characters. They're not even line breaks or spaces.
They're mutator characters.
They're literally 0 pixels wide.
That whole left to right character that can invert the run
right to left, yeah,
is such a trip. So you can do a left to right language and a right to left language in the same line of text,
right? Yeah, it's crazy.
So just looking this up, ActionScript 2.0 was in fact conformed partially to the ECMAScript 4th edition draft specification.
That was ActionScript 2, and everyone knows that's garbage.
Yeah, ActionScript 3 was the one that was the hotness, man.
And ActionScript 3 was a superset or built on top of ActionScript 2, though.
Yeah, but they also changed a lot of things to make it look a little bit more Java-y,
they added,
if I'm remembering right.
They added, ActionScript 3 added in ECMAScript for XML.
Oh, no.
No.
If you don't remember that, it's okay.
That should not be a thing you say ever.
My first hardcore object-oriented learning was in ActionScript 3.
Yeah, I did ActionScript 3 for a while, too.
Now, at the same time, ActionScript 3, bytecode was incompatible with 1.0 and 2.0. You had to recompile
your scripting language.
<Yeah.
laughs> Awesome.
Oh, it's fun.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. My name is Lyle Troxell. Today's title, is Self-Destructing Body Cams Go Solar by Greg Merkley up in Canada. My name's Lyle Troxell, and in the air was Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. Ben, Miles, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Someone else wrote it, but it was working. I wasn't touching it.
Uh-huh, because it worked.
And then there's this one particular corner case that it fails on. And after investigating, I found I had to rewrite the entire thing. So I've spent the last almost 2 weeks now rewriting this stuff, and I'm finally at the place where
it's the same.
Almost all of my unit tests pass.
That's nice. You had unit tests though.
Almost all of my films still render, and yeah, at least it's a little more readable.
Are you proud of it? Do you like it?
I'm proud of it. Yeah.
And you couldn't just fix the corner case?
No. No.
It was a very wide corner.
The problem was...
There you go.
Thank you.
Bare bones problem was that we had this JSON object that was functioning as a conditional, and it had a true case and it had a false case. And if you pass in a particular data structure, then it should render the true case. But because we just introduced JS tags, it was actually running the code for the true and the false case. The false case was failing, throwing an error, even though later it would have been pruned off the tree. So it was doing all of the parameter expansion before it was going through and reconciling all of the tags.
So this isn't a JSON object. JSON doesn't have functions.
JS object. Yeah. JSON
a generated
file.
One?
No.
Okay.
So, well, yeah, actually. Yeah.
So JSON specifically does not have any code. It only has...
JSON is a string. JSON is JavaScript object notation, which is just a string of...
Yeah, so but this thing was running code. How was it running code?
It was an object. It's a okay. Big object. Yeah. But I call it a JSON object because it's in a JSON file.
Yeah, so
and
it has
a tag.
Right.
So it's not really a JSON.
So technically object. If it has a function, it's not. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Okay.
Yeah, I know. You were vice president of the Pedant Society.
No. I think it's important for people to understand the difference between data and not data.
Yeah. But it was data. It was just stringified data.
Well, did it have methods in it?
No.
Well, how was it code that it ran then?
It was a markup. It's a markup language.
Uh-huh. Wait, was something else running the code?
Yeah.
Okay.
Something else was interpreting this markup language.
Got it.
And then we were able to finally upgrade Node from version freaking 0.10.22. And therefore, we were then able to pull in JavaScript and evaluate it and run it, not eval, but like require it in dynamically, mm-hmm. which is generally an anti-pattern, but in this case, it's fine. So now that we're finally able to do that, now we could make JS tags instead of these like weird...
Crazy things.
Yeah, object tags.
What's a JS tag?
It's a tag that's JavaScript. A tag is a... Think of a node in a tree, and that node... has logic on how to render itself.
Okay.
It's a custom element?
It's a custom element,
yeah. Oh, cool.
And it's got children and from
those
So
in the same
children.
Way that like React would work or like
yeah, it's very much like
or
React.
Custom elements with the browser, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Is that part of the JS spec? JavaScript spec?
Custom elements are part of the official, or I mean, they are a published spec that is supported by multiple browsers now. All major browsers now that I think of it.
And they're for JavaScript notation.
They allow you to, you know, have logic associated with a tag to be able to do, you know, a widget, or whatever. So instead of like an input element,
but is this
you
tag,
would
tag. When we say tags, is it a JavaScript property or is it a markup that's in the JavaScript?
No, it's markup RX. Within the HTML that gets bound to a tag. Is the custom element spec? I can't.
That's
speak
the custom
JS
element. Thing. Yeah. That's so. What's the JS tags thing?
What I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's an object that has a name, which is a string, and a render method, which is a function.
Oh, okay.
And the function takes in a node and a context, which has a render function. And okay. So then it can render its own children, and it can do whatever it
so
wants
a lot
to do.
Like React.
Very much like React, yeah, cool. Just with some differences. Yeah.
Yeah. Custom elements is supported natively by, everyone except Microsoft. Firefox is behind a flag.
Tail call optimization is not a node. That makes me sad. It was added to 6, and then I think they took it out of 8.
New JavaScript is awesome.
Yeah.
Although new Java is also pretty cool.
New Java?
Java 10 was just released, or that our release candidate.
Is that like JavaScript but smaller?
Java has created or introduced the var keyword.
I was 8 minutes ago I started recording.
Oh, cool.
So,
the what?
Java has introduced var.
Whoa, you sound like Miles now that I put my headphones on.
You sound like the podcast.
So now you don't have to specify the type ahead of time. You can just say var gets new. Rah, rah,
oh, cool.
Rah.
Like Groovy's def.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not good because types are nice. I like types.
No, it has types are still in there. It's just that types. It figures out you're assigning it from this thing. Therefore, this must be that type.
It's just not explicitly stated in your source code.
Right.
But it'll still throw you. It'll still throw.
It still reacts exactly things. The same. You just don't have to type it again.
Well, just
I like that.
Just like Groovy's def.
Yes.
Or JavaScript's jar var.
Although it doesn't have Groovy's JavaScript metaprogramming.
But JavaScript's var, JavaScript doesn't know what a variable is.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, it does.
It absolutely does.
It's just
you can run type of on a JavaScript.
But you can reassign it.
At runtime. But you can't do static analysis of it.
Yeah, you can.
Definitively.
You
don't know what your inputs are.
No, you can with TypeScript. As long as you are...
Yeah, but that's on JavaScript.
But TypeScript doesn't handle all of the situations, and neither does Flow.
Ben, of course it can. As long as you modify the language. Come on.
The trolling has begun.
It is. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, there are linters that will see that'll go through.
They'll figure it out.
Yeah, you
static
can.
Analysis and go like, wait, you're sending a string to this function. You're also sending a buffer.
But that's a static analysis thing. I mean, yes, that's
which is a compile step. So yeah,
except that it's not because it's an out. It's not part of the language. Not like types. I mean, come on. When you do a var. And you have to declare.
First off, you should never do var in JavaScript anymore.
Never let.
I was talking about Java.
Oh.
Because now they just added it for some reason. But the problems of scope is not the issue here. The problem is not exactly knowing what that type is. So your compiler has to know what that type is.
No, you know exactly what type it is because every function you write is going to have a type definition. Every time you do a new, you specify a type. You know exactly what type that is.
Then what
just
benefit
by following
is
it through.
You don't have to write it again. You don't have to write array list.
You can
blah,
be more
blah,
concise
foo,
with
get new array list. You can just say it's an array list,
and then never type it again.
Yeah,
doesn't seem like a
don't
big
repeat
win.
Yourself.
Doesn't seem like a big.
It's
win.
Totally dry.
Don't repeat yourself.
Don't repeat yourself. You haven't lost anything in terms of compile time checks in terms of
but you
static
have to...
types.
Okay,
it can do the type checking.
Yeah, and your SDK has to manage it for you.
The Java C manages it for you. It will tell you this is
know,
the wrong type.
It doesn't feel like a giant win. I mean, Java's – that's not the only – I don't know. There's a lot of verboseness. Yes, right. It gets rid of some of the verbosity. Okay.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of people don't like about Java is the verbosity.
That's why I don't like Java.
If you reduce the verbosity, you've increased people's like of Java.
I don't like Java language Java. If I could just call it Java, I'd be fine.
Miles, you have so many stories. Why so many stories?
Well, I'm not going to put all of them on there. I just figured like I'd preload them that
do
way.
Do you know what I had to do to get these to show up?
The stories?
Yeah. They expire after 7 days. They go away. You can't see them anymore. Yeah. So I had to go back into the bits and go find and modify.
Yeah.
Date. I did that all for Miles so he wouldn't have to lose his stories.
That's really sweet of you. Why 7 days?
Because I figured we did the show weekly, and if it had been over 7 days, it probably didn't matter.
Is
so
that like a
I only
a
see my
constant
stories
you can just
on
change?
Here.
Yeah, there aren't any other stories.
Oh, yeah. Oops.
The 7 days is totally hard-coded, like in the Ruby.
Oh.
Speaking of languages.
That's awesome that it's not like, you know, an SQL query, give me all the bits that are younger than a week.
That's what it is.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
But it's hard. Wait, but you said it was hard coded in Ruby.
Well, the week is. The week.
Okay.
The 7 days is the one that's hard coded. And it probably is like less than a week. It probably says that. Gotta find the code now. Can't do that in Java.
Really?
What?
Can't do what in Java?
The notation that I use here. Like last wait. Week, older than a week. It probably says that.
Wait, wait, wait. Your query for whether or not it was older than a week or not is in Ruby?
Of course it is. Why would it? I got it.
Why wouldn't you say it's in the database now minus
ugh.
1 week?
Ugh. Sounds horrible. No, you. Let's look at the two code for that. That'd be fun. You write the.
This is great radio.
It's not going to be. This is.
Let's look
doing,
at the code.
We're not
for
using
that,
any
we?
Of this. We're not using any of this shit. This is not going to be in there. I just said shit even. See? Can tell now.
Shite.
Oh, I got to review vulnerable dependencies. God damn it, Ruby. Okay, in my database. Oh, it's not in my database. It's in the controller.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, 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 dun.
All right, fine. So since no one else has brought up stories, I guess I just put the ones that I want to cover up on there.
Sounds good. Oh, man, it's not good. I don't like it. Miles is going to judge me. You know when I have feelings of imposter syndrome, I think about how Miles would judge my code. That's how I compare it.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because before.
I don't think about you very often.
That's just me. Like, I work for Facebook. I get paid. Like, I don't need to worry about old relationships.
Oh, if you used Facebook more, maybe I'd think. No, I'm kidding.
I use Facebook a lot.
I still don't. Oh, yeah, you do use Facebook a lot. Actually, I appreciate your Facebook usage. Yeah.
Yeah, everybody goes, oh, I love Miles' feedback. My sister, my mom, everybody loves your stuff.
Everyone loves you.
Yeah.
Always posting.
Or as you had put it to me a while back, you write angry very well.
Yeah, you do. You really do.
Is that a good thing?
I think there are
a lot of people who just like curse and rant and go all different directions. Like I have a very controlled anger in my writing.
Yeah.
It's something I talked about in a racial unity group that I'm a member of.
Sounds of Valley Racial Unity Group?
Yes. I have a constant undercurrent of rage.
Wait, don't do that anymore because maybe this is good. No, you keep doing the music. Go on. Start
a
again.
A constant undercurrent of rage,
yeah.
Basically at all times.
Yeah.
And Facebook ends up being my vent.
Mm.
Just be like,
it's the view.
I'm talking about it. I'm getting it off my chest. Here's that. Okay. Go on. Be happy with the rest of my day.
Does it help you do that?
Yeah. There's a place for me to put it.
Huh. Do you guys want to talk about functional paradigms in languages like JavaScript that are just conducive enough to functional programming that that you really, really like dig in, and then later debugging your code, you have to like figure out everything that's going on before you can understand any of it? Like I was kind of having that experience.
I haven't really had that experience of doing functional programming in JavaScript and having to really dig in to figure out what it's doing. Like in general, the functional programming has made things easier to understand.
Generally for me too. But recently I've been working with some code that is very like a lot of things are piped through functions that are piped through other functions that are composed with other functions, you know?
Mm-hmm. And that's where the name of functions becomes very important.
Right.
Naming
right,
them
yeah.
well.
Yeah, and
if it's not named well, then yes, I could see that being a major problem, or if it's not if the behavior is not consistent with the name.
So if they're named okay.
Yeah, that's not okay.
Okay, why are they called okay? Like, are they really short names?
No. Like, they're named, their names are only okay. Their names are not great. Their names are only okay. So if their names are only okay, then, like, I feel like that okayness versus goodness compounds with every function name you try to, you know, shove into your brain before you finally grok what's going on.
You also have the reverse run problem where because you're passing a function to a function to a function, you actually have to read it backwards.
Yeah.
That's kind of a problem. That's being changed in next year's.
That's
where
cool.
You actually have a methodology for reversing that order.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah, it's just hard. It can be hard to grok. And I guess my opinion is kind of that even if there's a way to do it really, really well, where you name everything really, really well, like that's not the world. It's kind of like saying, okay, well, I just won't write codes with bugs, right? Because, you know, writing code with bugs is a problem. So I just won't do that anymore.
Right.
Like that's not really a thing. You can't just not write code with
bugs. Always be bugs.
And similarly, you can't write in a functional style and name everything perfectly or well, like really well, unless you've already been doing it for a long time. Also, someone will eventually come along and mess up your beautiful naming, you know, like, mm-hmm. And they won't have the same context that you had going in. And so they'll make choices that will ultimately just obfuscate your code. So I guess I'm kind of coming to believe that, or coming to the conclusion myself that functional styles are great when you don't go really, really deep with them.
Hmm.
And that you shouldn't go really, really deep with them because they're not very maintainable across multiple developers, or unless you're not.
It depends on how you do the boundaries, right? Where if you're doing a lot of your complexity where it's a testable unit and you can put unit tests around it and then the input and output are pretty simple, then I think that it's pretty scalable.
But then you're trying to do a larger thing that is not encompassed by any of your unit tests, and all of your individual functions that you're using are doing their job, but the way that those functions are chained becomes hard to follow.
Yeah, I guess most of the time that I come across functional programming, admittedly is from the code that I've written late, is...
Which, you know, is mostly crap.
Yeah.
You said so yourself.
Is through, you know, map, filter, reduce.
Right. And that doesn't bother me at all.
Right. And inside of each map, filter, reduce, I might have a function that returns a function.
Right.
Like something that, you know, as int or as, you know...
Right.
You know, extract this or, you know...
Or a reusable filter that you've defined that's custom or something.
Right. And I guess I don't have all of that crazy composability that I've seen. I have seen that before.
Right.
Where people are, you know, 5-6 layers deep and are like, oh, look how clean you can just put, you can just compose it all together. And I totally get what you mean by, wait, what just happened?
Yeah.
And I guess when you just limit it to map, filter, reduce, sum, any, you don't have to do that retrograde analysis like you talked about before. It really stays in order. The only problem I have with JavaScript is the fact that each time it's giving back an array, a whole new array, as opposed to...
Not all of them. Most of them do that, but not all of them do that.
Well, all of the ones you want to use do that.
All true. The ones that are chainable where you're doing where you're doing a map, where you're doing...
Yeah, and so the memory bloat's kind of ridiculous.
Or a filter, something like that. Yeah. Well, I don't know about... Yeah. Yeah, it kind of is, but...
It can be. It depends on what you're doing, I guess, but yeah.
But as opposed to many... in C++, you can do it differently because you have pointers. So the iterator pattern that you have there. In Java, you have streams, the stream API from Java 8. And so you just have an iterator going through, and so you're not recomposing these arrays until you have the last step where you're collecting the results.
Yeah, but you're talking about a performance problem, right? Because conceptually, it doesn't really matter to you if it's actually producing a new array or not. I mean, it has to in JavaScript.
But that's the thing, though, is when you have something that's actually a stream, that means that you can put in an input stream like socket so that you never have to have the actual data set in memory. Mm-hmm. As it's coming in, you're filtering through it. And that's something that you can kind of fake in JavaScript, but it's really not baked in.
But a lot, yeah. And, of course, if you're dealing with like a JSON payload HTTP, that's going to be in-memory space by the time you access it, right? You're going to parse it at some point, unless you write a custom parser.
Yeah.
I definitely see the concern there.
Node 10, version 10, does have a version of V8 that allows you to have asynchronous iterators. And so you can re-implement something like this, but it doesn't change the fact that arrays as they exist right now, when you call map, filter, reduce, they're giving you back these, you know, concrete array items rather than working upon iterators, even though the language JavaScript supports iterators.
Have you done anything with Rx, reactive programming, Rx library?
No.
So an Rx library, conceptually, it's just a stream of closures that have like a promise, but instead of just being able to run, you can actually fail them and you complete the entire chain. So therefore, you can cancel them. So they have a little bit more ability to be composed than promises, and we use it extensively here in our Groovy layer. All across Netflix, we're using RX in our Groovy layer to compose things. So I'm doing a lot of stepping through these observable patterns and flat mapping. And they're like iterables, right? But they're an inverse of iterable because they're pushable. In any case, when you actually have a call, like when you actually have a problem, the call stack is really, and I've done a lot of it in JavaScript too, because the old iOS mobile app was a lot of RX in it. And when you do it with JavaScript and you do a console log of where you are, a stack trace kind of thing, what you find is that though conceptually you've been thinking of these things as objects, they're really recopying themselves all the time. There's a lot of recreation of these objects in temporary state to do the kind of same problem you're talking about of having an array and stepping through it. And actually when you filter an array, you actually make a new copy, that kind of thing.
So what are your thoughts on async await?
I haven't used it a lot. I've been away from JavaScript for 4 years because I've been in Objective-C land. We're using it everywhere here now, and it's a much better way of dealing with
Right. We were just talking about this at my company. We were talking – folks were having a company-wide discussion, getting some people trained up and saying, what are good code practices? And then folks that are more experienced, saying, what are we going to agree upon as what we should do? It's a really fun effort. And at the same time, the question came up on the most recent one saying, okay, you have these promises. What is the right way to do error handling? Mm-hmm. And the way that may seem –
that's a classic error problem right now.
What may seem intuitive when using then, catch isn't when you go to async await. And the fact is that promises made this really weird side paradigm that people are trying to deal with. And if you – And basically my advice to everyone that was there was because I had given a brown bag on async await several months back, which is everything with promises is moving toward async await. A lot of them are doing that. And so you should be doing it in terms of how would you do this with the try-catch block, not how you do with promises. Try to organize your promises to be like the try-catch block, not the other way around.
Promises are a ugly fill. They're not right. They'll go away. I personally avoid them.
Well, async await is promises.
Yep.
That's how they're implemented.
Yep.
When you do an async function, it returns new promise.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And so you say await function, that function is a promise.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know that it is a problem.
It's the underlying implementation that gets covered up, but it's also convenient. You kind of need to know about promises.
Callbacks aren't transposable to try catch. Promises are.
Right.
Yes. Well, no, promises aren't transposable to try catch. That's actually
they are.
That's what async await is about, is that you can just do a try catch block.
You say
that's
try.
That's the whole point.
Interesting.
Try await.
When you generate
promise.
Yeah.
And then
have a try catch block around a sequence of three awaits, and then you exit that catch block because that's where you would be handling that section.
Do you think that a try catch is the right way to say this operation didn't succeed the way you intended?
I believe that.
See, in an observable world, you'd actually have I errored or not, and you're not throwing.
Well, first off, exceptions, I believe, should be thrown in
as a Java developer.
In truly exceptional cases.
Okay, there you go.
Not as a general course. Usually things that you have no control over.
Okay, so I have an async event that I want to just get some data from a REST request. So the promise sends out, and it should give me back data, but the HTTP, the network's not down or something, there's no request that happens. Do you think that's a throw?
No.
How would you implement that?
The fetch API, which is you make that request, and if it comes back that the service is down, that I consider exceptional.
Okay,
that
so you're saying that network activity not access is exceptional. Have you ever done mobile development? Happens all the time. It's not exceptional. It happens all the time.
Well, mobile development adds in that whole other layer of you doing service workers and stuff like that. I'm talking about progressive web apps, but
the problem escape is the same issue, right? You're basically saying
you are talking
thing,
about you're
it's either
going to
give you data or it's going to fail miserably with.
You are also talking about a different problem space than I am.
Okay,
because I've been spending most of my time on the server side. Server side, that resource is going to
be highly reliable.
It may give back a 500 error, but that's not an exception. That's check the status code. What did you get back? That's an if statement. That's a conditional. And then you move on. If you can't resolve the name, if you have no route to it, from the server side perspective of programming, Yes, that's I consider that exceptional. From the client point of view...
Yeah, that's different because that's a normal case. You're in a tunnel.
Yeah. From a client point of view, if you're talking about mobile, if you're talking about a web client, that's where I see you have service workers, which should be taking on that role of if the resource is not available, if you are offline, yeah, you get back some resource that tells you that you're offline. You're not throwing an exception in that case either.
But is that service worker going to be using promises with exceptions? Or is the service – because you're just moving that problem into the service worker code. Still
– No, not at all. Service worker – the point of a service worker is to say, do I actually have a network connection? I don't. Give back this information instead from a cache.
Yeah, that's
that
not
populated.
An error.
Okay, I see what you're saying. But when it tries to connect, you wouldn't and you when you coded that, you wouldn't throw at that point because it tried to connect, it couldn't? Because
no,
it doesn't make sense.
No, because that's a normal case.
Right.
Yeah.
The service normal worker, case so you tried, you're in a Caltrain tunnel, it failed, so the service worker returns something on its own. You don't have to...
Yeah, but you do have to implement the service worker yourself, and if you want to use promises in that space...
Well, the service,
yeah, but,
the service
that's
worker,
what it's for, though.
Yeah, the whole point of service worker is to say, what is your cache methodology? What is the expectation if you don't have network access?
I guess my point, about, my point about insulting promises is that it's a, it's a one type of contract. It is a... The interface is, first off, go do, go do this thing, and there's no way to cancel it, and there's no way to find out how it's going. And when you get response back, it either is catastrophic or it's what you get. And there's no other granularity. It's very it's just a closure with nothing else around it.
Cancelable. Yes, that is an issue to be able to specifically cancel. Mm-hmm. At the same time, most cases that I come across – and I get that the minor case, the corner case is the one that ends up giving us the headaches and we have to spend a whole bunch of time on. But the major case for fetching a network resource is, have I set what my timeout value is supposed to be?
Yeah.
And it really is kind of like, I want that. I'm going to wait for it to come back to me.
Unless, of course, the user like navigates away and then you don't want it. There's no way to cancel it. It's going to keep going. The resource is there. The closure is not available.
On the contrary, if you navigate away?
Well, now we're talking about a browser navigation. But my point is that if the user changes intent and you want to cancel a whole bunch of promises, no. The protocol itself is kind of weak. The other thing that it does is it's equivalent to a one value, right? It's not like an array. It's not an iterable. It doesn't have these other richnesses of other data forms.
Wait,
like a stream.
I don't understand. It's not an array. It's not a.
See, I should show you observe. I should show you Rx and like how it works. It's just a different way of thinking about it.
Because a promise can give back an iterable.
It can, give back an item that is an iterable. It can give back an item, but it can't be an iterable. Because it's a one-time thing.
Right. It's a promise to say I'm going to give you a value eventually.
Right. But if instead you had you set up a data structure where you say multiple things are going to come back to you. Sometimes there'll be errors and sometimes they'll be not errors. And these are the promises that I'm iterating over. That's what an observable stream
is. Multiple promises.
Well, except that you want to set the data structure. You don't want to set up multiple instances of the promises.
Yeah,
you would instead
kind of
start
depends on
that
your
process.
Use case.
Yeah,
right?
That's not all.
Are you trying to fetch three things or are you trying to fetch some indefinite number of things and you're waiting for it? You know what I mean? Like we're solving different – we have different cases that we're solving.
Right, but the pattern that I'm envisioning solves the promise pattern, but the promise pattern doesn't solve the one I'm talking about.
Right.
So it's kind of like, you know, using an array – as your data storage versus using an int as your data storage.
Of course.
One just has more depth than
a promise is a standard. And
yeah. It's like a value.
RX is a library, right?
By the way, if you use Bluebird for promises in Node, you know, server side, then you can cancel.
Yeah. Just not real promises.
Right. So I would argue that's a better.
You can still use await with a Bluebird promise.
No. I'm saying real promises you can't cancel, but Bluebird promises you can, and you can use await with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, and that's a library, just like Rx is a library, right? So, there you go.
Anyway.
I mean, aside from things that are where you set a variable outside in the closure to be able to say, like, I'm canceling this, but – and which may end up being the right thing to do in a lot of cases because to say cancel this, what does that even mean? Like,
well, it depends on the implementation of the – code that's being canceled.
Well, that's the thing, though. It depends upon what you are actually trying to accomplish, and every case is going to be a little different in terms of are you supposed to clean up resources afterwards? Are you supposed to send back an error message? Are you supposed to say, wait, when I say cancel, I have a certain checkpoint that I want to cancel. I don't mean cancel exactly that moment. I say wait until you get to a point that would be safer.
Is there anything that a promise you can replay the a promise's value?
Replay it?
Mm-hmm. If you had four people subscribing to the promise at once, can't do that, right?
Not sure what you're meaning. I would.
It's okay. Don't worry about it.
No, that's fine. What you're describing in terms of you have a whole bunch of people that want to get information from an asynchronous thing, I would think of it as an event,
mm-hmm.
not as a promise.
I'd agree.
That's an event handler.
Yeah. So you can imagine an event handler. You know what? We won't get into this because it's not
good radio. We
already have. No, we're done. But the place I'm talking about is that RX pattern using observables. And you can do those things. You can actually surface an entire event stream like keystrokes as an observable stream that gives you observables that you can execute that have the values in them. You can cancel the entire thing. You can start the entire thing and they get pushed to you. So it's another way of thinking about data flow in UI.
Hey, Lyle.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about RX? Because I could actually ask you questions instead.
Well, I don't know how good I am about it though.
Instead of comparing them to promises.
Refresh.
I saw the order, but are these order of most compelling to individuals that are not developers?
Oh, we lost those people a long time ago.
Oh no, we're putting that at the end.
Okay.
I was actually considering. Yeah, that's the order.
And
stuff.
Ben, I'll start with you after the first one of Miles's. I don't know what it is that you're going to say. But.
Oh, I was just going to say that Dig Reader has shut down. Google Reader shut down a long time ago, and then Dig Reader was one of the things that took its place, and that's what I used to find stories for Geekspeak.
Oh. Your stories, you have no...
Feedly.
And so Dig Reader shut down a while back, and I cursed because I thought, okay, well, now when I'm on Geekspeak next, I need to go find another feed reader and set it up and everything, and I have not done that.
Feedly.
So yeah, I do have a Feedly account. I just need to go and dig out the password and export all my data from Dig Reader and... imported into Feedly.
It's funny to me that I signed up for Feedly right when Google Reader was getting canceled. And it was just so seamless because you're using a Google login, a federated login through Feedly, and then it took all the settings from Google Reader. It was like I hadn't... It was really so seamless and easy. It was ridiculous.
Whoa! I just did that, and it just worked. Now I'm on Feedly.
See?
That's amazing.
It kills me that RSS isn't more ubiquitous. I kind of feel like there's a business opportunity out there for someone to try to now belatedly talk to established newspaper vendors and say, stop putting up paywalls, stop trying to go on this on your own, and go with like a newspaper rack. And Apple's tried to do this, but they're still kind of locked in to be able to say, you know, have an RSS feed from each of the news vendors, and then someone can subscribe to each one of them, and it just shows up as a news feed, you know, as a RSS unified news
feed. The full content or partial?
The full. The idea that you would sign in to the system to be able to give your subscription credentials for each item, you know, for whatever papers you wanted, for Washington Post and, you know, whatever else. And then have it, you know, you have all of the articles of the day from all of those news sources.
That's a better way to read newspapers.
Because right now...
The websites are so bad.
Because I don't want to just get a subscription to Washington Post and then remember to have to go to Washington Post just to find the information, because that's not how I get my information. I get my information because I'm on Twitter and someone links to Washington Post, and then they link to, you know, Mother Jones, and then they link to Reuters. Like, I don't get my news by going to a single news source and then reading the articles. Like, that model is just dead. But it would require that all these news organizations actually work together.
Washington Post has an RSS feed.
They do. They also have a paywall that if you read more than 3 articles in a month, they go like, yep.
Well, that's fine. You got to pay for your news. To subscribe to the new RSS feed, click here. The words are bolded. They are not clickable. You can find a complete blog directory here and a list of RSS feeds here.
And maybe I'm just overthinking it. Maybe I should just, you know, put the Washington Post feed onto my Feedly.
Yeah,
that would work too.
They're not full feeds, which kind of makes sense.